For the present, immediately after his investiture, he undertook by boat and car a journey of inspection through the country, accompanied by a staff of secretaries chosen by himself, mostly young men not yet fossilized by the jog-trot of office. He did this to acquire first-hand knowledge of the Black Earth, and before he took any concrete measures, to make himself, in actual fact, master of the survey. The conditions of property were peculiarly vague and undefined. Theoretically, the soil, like everything else, belonged to Pharaoh. The lands, including the conquered or tributary provinces as far as the wretched land of Nubia and the borders of Mitanni land, were Pharaoh's private property. But the actual state domains, the estates of Pharaoh as special crown lands, were distinct from the estates which earlier kings had presented to their great men, as well as from the property of small nobles and peasants which passed as personal property of their proprietors, although, to be exact, the situation was more in the nature of leasehold and rental, while preserving the right of inheritance. The only exceptions were the temple lands, especially the acres of Amun, which were all freehold and tax-free, and those remnants of an older structure made up of special immunities, proprietary rights of single district princes who were still powerful and behaved as though they were independent, inherited estates which stood out here and there all through the kingdom like islands of an obsolete feudalism, and, like the acres of the church, expected to be considered the unqualified property of their owners. But whereas those latter were on principle left in peace by Joseph's administration, he went after the obdurate barons tooth and nail from the very beginning. He included their estates without more ado in his system of taxation and reservation, and in time arrived at simple expropriation in favor of the crown. It is not correct to say that the peculiar agrarian constitution of the so-called New Kingdom, a phenomenon so striking to other peoples, namely, that in the lands of the Nile, all the soil except the properties of the priesthoods belonged to the king, was created by the measures taken by Jacob's son. For what he did only completed the process well on the way, by defining, regularizing, and legalizing, so that they became clear to the people, conditions which had existed before his time. His travels did not extend to the Negro lands, or to the districts of Syria and Canaan, as he sent commissioners into these regions instead. Even so, his tour of inspection took between 2 and 3 times 17 days. There was so much to inspect and have recorded. Then he went back to the capital, where he established himself with a staff in a government building on the Street of the Sun, and from there, well before the harvest, issued in Pharaoh's name the famous Land Law, which was immediately proclaimed throughout the country. Universally, and without respect to person or crop failure, it fixed the produce tax at 1/5, to be delivered into the royal storehouses punctually and without notice, or, if with notice, certainly in peremptory terms. At the same time, the children of Egypt could see that all over the country, in the cities large and small, and the regions round about, these storehouses were enlarged and increased in number by the labors of a large force of workmen. Certainly it looked as though there were more than were needed, because at first, of course, many of them stood empty. Yet more and more were built, for the undue number, so it was said, was reckoned on the abundance which had been foretold by the new Adon of distribution and friend of the harvest of God. Wherever you went, you saw the skittle-shaped corn bins standing in close rows or grouped into squares around courts. They opened on top to receive the corn, and had stout doors below to empty it out by, and they were built with unusual solidity on terraced platforms of pounded clay to protect them from damp and mice. There were also numerous underground pits for the storage of grain, well lined, with almost invisible entrances, guarded by police. It is pleasant to report that both measures, the tax law and the construction of the big magazines, enjoyed decided popularity. Taxes there had always been, of course, in many forms. Not for nothing had old Jacob, who had never been in Egypt, but had built up an emotional picture of it, been used to talk about the Egyptian house of bondage, even though his mistrust took too little account of the conditions peculiar to the country. The labor of the children of Keme belonged to the king. That was taken for granted, and it was used to erect enormous tombs and incredibly ostentatious public buildings. Yes, certainly it was used for that, but it was even more in demand for works of necessity, for all the digging and hoisting operations indispensable to the prosperity of this peculiar and extraordinary land of oases, for keeping the waterways in good condition, digging ditches and canals, manning the sluices, strengthening the dams. All these things were a matter of the general welfare, and could not be left to the imperfect intelligence and improbable personal industry of subordinates. Therefore, the government kept its children's noses to the grindstone. They had to work for the state. And when they had worked, then they had to pay taxes on what they had done. They had to pay taxes for the canals, lakes, and ditches they used, for the irrigation machinery and sluices which served them, and even for the sycamore trees which grew on their fertilized soil. They paid for house and farmyard and everything that house and farmyard produced. They paid with skins and copper, with wood, rope, paper, linen, and always, since time immemorial, with corn. But the taxes were levied at the very uneven discretion of the regional administrators and village overseers, according to whether the nourisher, that is to say, Hopi, the river, had been great or small, and that, of course, was sensible enough. But between connivance on the one hand and extortion on the other, there was much room for bribery and favoritism and good reason to complain. We may say that from the first day, Joseph's administration tightened the reins on the one hand and loosened them on the other. That is, he put all the emphasis on the corn rent and looked very leniently at other debts. The people might keep their linen of the first, second, and third quality, their oil, copper, and paper, if only the corn delivery, the fifth of the bread grain harvest, was conscientiously handed over. This explicit and universal tax provision could not be regarded as oppressive in a country where the fertility is on the average 30-fold. Moreover, it had a certain legendary charm and metaphysical appeal, since it had been shrewdly and intentionally taken from the sacred intercalary figure of the 5 extra days after the 360 making up the year. And lastly, it pleased the people that Joseph unhesitatingly levied the tax on the still recalcitrant district barons as well, and forced them to make up-to-date improvements on their properties for the good of the state. For the reactionary spirit of these men operated to keep their estates in a condition far behind the times. The irrigation system was clumsy and inadequate. They retained it partly out of laziness, but mostly out of defiance, and thus the soil yielded less than it should have done. To this gentry, Joseph emphatically prescribed the repair of their water systems, recalling, as he did so, a certain Saleph, an uncle of Eber, about whom Eliezer had told him, that he was the first man to turn the brooks onto his property, and thus was the inventor of irrigation. Now, as for the new erections, the extraordinary measures taken to heap up the surpluses, the Egyptian national idea of thrift and foresight is probably the best explanation of the fact that Keme's children liked them well. Joseph's own personal tradition of the flood and the brilliant idea of the ark which saved the human race as well as all animal creation from complete extinction was in harmony here with the instinct for security and defense deep-rooted in this very vulnerable civilization which had waxed old despite the precarious circumstances under which it lived. Egypt's children even tended to see something magic about Joseph's storehouses. They themselves were practiced in fending off evil and malicious demons by setting up some kind of impediment, impenetrable as possible, in the way of magic symbols and signs. Thus, in their minds, the ideas of foresight and magic were easily interchangeable. They found it not hard to see even such prosaic arrangements as Joseph's corn bins in the light of enchantments and spells. In a word, the impression prevailed that Pharaoh, young himself, had made a lucky hit when he installed in office this young father of the harvest and shadow dispenser. His authority was destined to wax exceedingly in the course of the years, but even now it was favored by the circumstance that this year the Nile had been very great, and a far greater crop than usual was harvested under the new management, particularly of wheat, green rye, and barley, and abundance of dura corn could be gleaned from the stalks. We may have our doubts about including in the 7 years, one of which the prosperity was already certain when Joseph took office. It may not be allowable to count it as one of the years of the fat kine, but it was later so counted, probably in an attempt to bring the number of the blessing years up to 7, though even so they did not quite reach that figure. In any case, it was pleasant for Joseph that he took over the business under conditions of prosperity and plenty. Popular psychology always has been and always will be, quite self-respectingly, without rhyme or reason. If a minister of agriculture takes office in a period of prosperity, public opinion is quite capable of thinking he is a good minister. Thus, when Jacob's son drove through the streets of Weset, the populace greeted him with lifted hands and shouted, "Adon, Adon, Kane Keme, live forever, friend of the harvest of God." Many even cried, "Happy, happy," and carried their right hands, thumb and forefinger pressed together, to their mouths, which was going rather far, and must be ascribed in large part to their childish enthusiasm for his handsome person. But he very seldom drove out, being exceedingly busy. Urim and Thummim. Whatever we do in life is determined by fundamental tastes and sympathies, by deep-lying private destinies which color our whole existence and dye all our doing. These are responsible for our acts. These, and not any of the reasonable grounds we are likely to adduce to others and to ourselves. The king's chief mouthpiece and overseer of all his stores, a short time after he entered office, very much against Pharaoh's wish, who would gladly have kept his new friend near him for discourse about his father who was in heaven, and with his help to labor on the improvement of the teaching, moved his residence and all his offices from Noet Amun, the capital, to Menphe, in the north, home of the swaddled one. The external, but probably quite justifiable, ground for the change lay in the fact that thick-walled Menphe was the balance of the lands, the center and symbol of the equilibrium of Egypt, and well suited for the residence of the master of the survey. Of course, that about the balance of the lands was not strictly accurate. Menpi lay really quite far north, near On, the city of the blinking and the cities of the 7 mouths. If one reckoned that Egypt reached only to the Elephant Isle and the island Pilak, and did not count Negritia, then the city of King Mira, where his beauty lay buried, was by no means the balance of the lands, but lay as much too far north as Thebes lay too far south. Nevertheless, age-old Menphe continued to be thought of as the balance, and it was axiomatic that it held a commanding position and was a point of vantage for both upstream and down. At any rate, such was the argument upon which the Egyptian Joseph based his decision, and Pharaoh himself could not deny that the trade with the Syrian port cities, when they sent down into the granary, as they called the land of the black earth, to buy grain, was easier from Menphe than from Per Amun. All this was perfectly true, and yet these were only the external, the rational grounds for Joseph's decision to get Pharaoh's permission to live in Menphe. The real and decisive reasons were in his heart, where they lay so deep and reached so far that they involved his whole attitude to life and death.